Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for finding Whitehall Sources. Before we get stuck into the politics for you, a quick message from The Resident. These hotels, like their choice in podcasts, are exceptional. Whether you're traveling for business or leisure, at The Resident, you're offered the best rooms, prices, and advice for your needs as well. We are so thrilled to be brought to you in association with The Resident, who have proudly backed us since day one. When we're booking a stay in London or Liverpool, it's The Resident we head to, and it's The Resident you should head to. To find out more, click residenthotels.com. Hello and welcome to Whitehall Sources. I'm Callum McDonald. We're recording on Wednesday the 13th of March. If you are new here, you're very welcome. This is your political insidery podcast with people who have lived it, who have been there, who have done that, who have run the country, basically. One of those people is Kirsty Buchanan, who was a special advisor to Theresa May when she was Prime Minister. Hello, Kirsty.
Hello. How I wish I had run the country. I was running the country adjacent firmly, more than anything, but yeah.
I firmly believe you were running the country. Great to see you. Lots to get through today. Actually, a lot of the episode is going to be given over to the Institute for Government, who this week published a report looking at actually how the function and systems of government should change, specifically at number 10 and the Cabinet Office. And, well, the Treasury is in there as well. Actually, the Treasury held up as an example of something that is working. And so more lessons to be learned, I suppose. We've got Alex Thomas, friend of the podcast, joining us to discuss that in more detail. And honestly, it's political nerdery done right. It's really, really fascinating to hear what the IFG... And by the way, this report was launched by Gordon Brown and John Major, among others. So, you know, there's some serious people who are on board with this. So Alex Thomas will join us on the podcast in a bit. But first of all, Kirsty, to the story of the last couple of days, actually, and this is the one about the racist party donor. This is Frank Hester, who allegedly made comments saying that Diane Abbott, currently an MP without the whip, formerly a Labour MP, but MP Diane Abbott should be shot. This Conservative donor, Frank Hester, has donated more than £10 million to the Conservatives. In November, he also gifted Rishi Sunak the use of a helicopter for a political visit. And Rishi Sunak, well, it took him a while, first of all, Kirsty, to come out and say that these comments were racist. And that was only after Kemi Badenoch had said so. And it was only after government ministers had been sent out to basically say anything but that they were racist and sort of fudge around it a bit. Yesterday, Tuesday, reminded me of the last days of Boris Johnson, where ministers were being sent out to defend the indefensible. And by lunchtime, it was all crumbling. And by the end of the day, the message had changed completely.
Yeah. Look, I mean, there's a sort of general rule in comms or in life, really. And I think I've probably talked about it before. I used to call it the Eric Pickles rule of acceptability. And, you know, in politics, you've got to stop sometimes, look at what is said and say, is that what it is on the tin? And if it is what it is on the tin, then I should call it out for what it is. And when you get into a situation like you had yesterday where the climate change minister, Graham Stewart, and the work and pension secretary, Mel Stride, were sent out in the morning with an indefensible line to take, a clearly indefensible line, where they equivocated about whether something... And by the way, Hester, you know, I don't think we need to say allegedly. Hester is not denying that he said this. He's not denying, you know, or saying it was taken out of context. He's owned what he said. He's apologized profusely for it. So it is not, you know, a contested comment in that sense. What it is clearly racist, unequivocally so. And yet the two ministers were sent out in the morning to dance around a pinhead on it and sort of, you know, and say, well, it was ill-judged, but I'm, you know, I'm not entirely sure that we should call it racist. Yes, we should. You know, there is no world. Mm. I would sort of like to sort of, sometimes you just get so caught in the politics of things, you kind of lose your, you know, your basic instinct. And Diane Abbott, who, by the way, you know, has had more abuse and probably threats than any other single MP, probably in the history of British MPs. I listened to Shami Chakrabarti yesterday on the radio in the morning. Now, Shami is a very close friend of Diane Abbott. I mean, Shami's a, you know, a strong, resilient and robust woman. I've never heard her so upset in my life on a radio program. She was almost in tears because not only was this, you know, racist, this point about she should be shot, just, you know, in a world where we've had not one but two MPs murdered, in a world where debate is so toxic and so polarized. And I know he said this, but he said this 5 years ago, fine, but he didn't say this like in 1950 when he was five or whatever. You know, this is a relatively recent comment. For it to surface now at such a point of toxicity for a woman who spends half her life, or probably most of her life, looking over her shoulder and worrying about her safety, perfectly reasonably, because she gets the sort of abuse that most of us would have ducked out of politics a very long time ago. If we got this, you know, regardless of your politics on it, think about if this was your friend or your wife, what you would think. If he'd said those same comments about Rishi Sunak's wife, would he had any equivocation about whether they were racist or not? Would he have had any equivocation about whether they were, you know, appalling, unacceptable and completely beyond the pale? No, of course he wouldn't, you know. And it's the same argument that, you know, a lot of the time you have to make on a flip side with anti-Semitism. Take this issue, supplant it with something that matters to you or somebody that matters to you, and say to yourself, how would I emotionally feel about that? So I don't care what you think about Diane Abbott. That was an appalling, racist thing to say. If it was said about someone that was a friend of mine or friend of someone, you know, anybody's, we would be as upset as Shami Chakrabarti. Why on earth that takes you, you know, most of the day to work out what is clearly, you know, an unequivocal, not up for debate position is utterly beyond me, utterly beyond me. And at a very point where on things like this, you know, politicians should absolutely come together and call it out for what it is and say this is entirely unacceptable, to equivocate, to send MPs and ministers out to defend the indefensible, I just thought was just a new low. Really, really badly handled and just wrong. Just wrong.
I should say, by the way, that I only mentioned really part of the comment at the start of this. The other part of the remark is that Diane Abbott made him, quote, just want to hate all black women. So if you're in any doubt about whether it's racist or not, well, be in no doubt from here on. It's a bizarre one from the point of view that it is still dominating the news agenda because, and I mean the bizarre bit, is because Number 10 has been fumbling it so badly. And I just wonder how it resolves. We had PMQs today where Stephen Flynn, of the SNP, accused Sunak of putting money before morals, which is quite a catchy line, and it's the sort of thing that sticks. Keir Starmer obviously was going on this as well, saying the man bankrolling the Prime Minister said that Diane Abbott should be shot. How low would he have to sink? What racist, woman-hating threat of violence would he have to make before the Prime Minister plucked up the courage to hand back the £10 million that he's taken from him? And Rishi Sunak, his response, I suppose, almost feels a bit, well, it feels inadequate, really. He said, the alleged comments were wrong. They were racist. He has rightly apologised for them, and that remorse should be accepted. There's no place for racism in Britain. The government I lead is living proof of that. Starmer talks about language. You might want to reflect on his double standard to the deputy leader, calling her opponent scum. His shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy comparing Conservatives to Nazis, and the man he wanted to make Chancellor talking about lynching a female minister. his silence on that speaks volumes. So there's two things on this. One is Rishi Sunak came prepared with ammunition on where Keir Starmer may have misstepped on members of his party's language. I was listening to Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio today during Prime Minister's questions, and he made the point that he'd far rather be called scum than be sort of told that that somebody wanted to shoot him. So actually, there might be a slight false equivalence there. The Nazis one is perhaps slightly more difficult, and lynching is certainly very problematic from John McDonnell. But I just wonder if actually this is a constructive way to have this discussion.
No, and to be fair, seeking to extend the row out by, you know, demanding that they hand back the money, you know, to some certain extent that is political gameplay. I mean, I don't think either side on this is showering itself in much glory in terms of trying to exploit this for maximum amounts of political capital. Had Number 10 handled this better, and it's hard to see how they could have handled it worse, then perhaps this issue about, you know, handing back the money might not have gained as much traction as it had. But Keir Starmer's always, always going to be on shaky footing when he challenges the Prime Minister around attitudes to, tackling racism, because Keir Starmer served in the shadow cabinet of Jeremy Corbyn, and he served in silence while, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn became an open cesspit of anti-Semitism. He's never, ever going to be able to shake off the charge that, you know, he's a flaming hypocrite when it comes to this kind of thing. Having said all that, does, you know, the hate Olympics, if you like, does it make either side any the better for it? Does it make either of these things any more or less justifiable? No, it doesn't. All it does is make the public look at politicians and think, well, a plague on both your houses, you know. The whole thing is pretty unedifying. It was just extraordinarily badly handled. Sometimes, as I say, you've just got to look at your basic humanity and, you know, frankly, fudge the politics of it. And by fudge, I mean the swear word, not fudge politics. Let's try it again. Balls to the politics of it, and just have a basic human response. Because if that, like I say, that was said about, you know, a colleague of yours or a friend of yours, what would be your basic human response? Yeah. That is the point. This is not one for political point scoring. This is one where, you know, doing the right thing and then not trying to extend it out into a, well, you had this horrible person in your party and you had this horrible person in your party. Just not extend it out like that, because that's not the point here. The point here is our public debate has become so toxic and we are talking so much about the threat to MPs that this is not the time to exacerbate those divides and talk about those divides and try and string this out and score a few more points. Just everybody call it out for what it is. That's it. End of.
Thanks, Kirsty. Yeah, that story dominating much of the last couple of days, probably going to be dominating tomorrow as well. And since this is the first time that we have been together on the pod, since a big announcement was made in the Maidenhead advertiser, I think we should reflect on the departure of Theresa May, who will be standing down come the next election, standing down as an MP, of course, come the next election. What do you think, Kirsty? How do you reflect on Theresa May's departure from the House of Commons?
First of all, I'm not surprised. It was clear that, you know, her premiership, she was going to want to devote more time to, you know, her real passion in politics, which is, you know, providing a voice for the voiceless and combating modern slavery. I suspect that the only pull that she had that made her want to stay was her constituents. She's always been a fantastic constituency MP. I sent her a little text when the news broke, or quite a long text actually, basically to sort of say, you know, I am delighted for her, because, you know, anybody that knows her, you know, one of the greatest shames, I think, about the kind of sliding doors of history, if you like, was that her premiership was bogged down by Brexit. And I think I've said to you before, you know, I once listened to another podcast where someone did an interview with Theresa May, and it was like, listen to Theresa May. You've never heard of Theresa May like this before. It's incredible. And I listened to it and I thought, well, that's the Theresa May I know, because she was talking about the launch of her book. She was talking about the things that she went into politics for, the things that she really cares about, which is, you know, tackling injustices, tackling social injustice, giving a voice to people and standing up against vested interests. And if you talk to her about these things, her demeanour, her face, her manner completely transforms, and you get this incredibly passionate advocate for people who are in desperate need of having some real high-profile passionate advocates. I think she can make a real difference in this arena. And I'm, you know, and I'm kind of all for it. And I said, look, if you, you know, you need any pro bono support on any of your campaign work, count me in. So yeah, look, is Parliament, well, not Parliament, the Commons will be the worse off for not having her in it, for sure. I think the good folk of Maidenhead will have to go a very long way before they ever get a constituency MP as devoted and brilliant as Theresa May again. But I hope that the world will be a little better place for her being able to work full time on something that she cares so passionately about and can, you know, really work the international stage and really help to affect positive change. And I am all for it. I'm, you know, I'm delighted to hear it. I hope that she doesn't leave Parliament entirely. I assume and hope she gets a seat in the Lords. But, you know, I think it's a great, it's exactly what she should be doing. You know, there is a, you know, there's a career after politics. You know, if you look at William Hague now, who, you know, is one of the most respected, you know, campaigners and advocates in the country, you know, no matter what your tenure was like and what, it doesn't define you. And lots of prime ministers have gone on to do fantastic things and become, you know, a real force for good in the country. And I absolutely think she'll be one of them.
Lovely. Thank you. That's very fitting. Very warm. And yes, a reminder that actually politics at times can have a little bit of niceness about it and a little bit of kind of devotion to duty as well. Thanks, Kirsty. Right, lots still to come on Whitehall Sources then. In a few minutes, we're going to welcome Alex Thomas from the Institute for Government to talk through how government should work better. And this is important. This is important. It's important for you that government functions properly. And the IFG have basically identified areas in which that is not happening. And so they're recommending how to make it better. Stay with us. Alex Thomas is on the podcast next.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Oh, hello. Well, you thought you'd got rid of me, didn't you? Well, here I am in the break as well. You are welcome. Here at Whitehall Sources, we are always enthusiastic about rigorous journalism. So we have been tapping up our very special sources to find out more about The Resident, which says it has excellent rooms in exceptional locations, providing heartfelt hospitality. I'm pleased to say their story checks out, actually. Here's one of our sources, Bossman56, who says, just spent 3 days at the Resident Covent Garden. Room was excellent, so were the staff. The room and the hotel, clean and tidy. Staff were friendly and very efficient. Will be going back soon. And in the interest of double sourcing, it's just what we have to do as rigorous journalists. How about this from Gufton, which I assume must be a codename. The best hotel I've stayed at in London. The customer service was unsurpassed from the moment I walked in the door. It actually all makes us very proud to be supported by The Resident on Whitehall Sources. And you can join The Resident online. Go to residenthotels.com. And if you all do that, they'll actually just be very pleased with us. So go to residenthotels.com. Thank you. is Whitehall Sources. Thanks so much for being with us. We are joined by Alex Thomas from the Institute for Government. Hello, Alex.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Cal.
Great to speak to you again. Thanks for joining us. And, well, Kirsty, you should probably tee this up, really, because, listeners, to take you behind the scenes, Kirsty was watching an event from the Institute for Government yesterday and texted me, all aglow with what had been discussed by the panel. And Kirsty, so basically this is about sort of changing up the operation of Whitehall and how government actually functions. Am I right? Tell us a little bit about what made you excited by it.
Yeah, so I mean, I will let Alex talk to the kind of the headline points and the recommendations it makes in it. But in essence, first of all, just the quality of the people involved in this report and involved in the launch. We had, you know, Gus O'Donnell, who was known in the civil service back in the day as God, only in parts because of his initials, and just a wonderful, wonderful cabinet secretary, used to be the head of the civil service. We had Louise Casey, who everyone will know is, you know, rightly drafted on to speak truth and, you know, common sense on a range of subjects in government over the years. And it's been an honour for me to work alongside Louise Casey, myself, a wonderful person. Anthony Seldon, who's one of the greatest writers and thinkers in the country. And then obviously talking to the report on the day, Gordon, not one, but two prime ministers, and both of them kind of quality prime ministers as well. not one of these like 50-day one-hit wonders prime ministers. We had Gordon Brown and John Major. And the essence of this and the thing that came through most clearly and starkly, there were differences about, you know, of opinion around the recommendations, and I'll let Alex talk to those in a minute. But the thing that came through most clearly was everybody in the room thought sort of three things really that really struck me. One, there was an overwhelming consensus over the urgent need to have significant reform at the very heart of government. And that one of the things we've seen with COVID, which is some of the system of the operation of Number 10 and Cabinet Office and Treasury, is that actually getting in the way of good delivery. And there was an overwhelming belief that that was the case. Secondly, that the sheer scale of these big transitional issues that we face now means that, you know, we're not talking about, you know, improving the operation because we need to tinker with X, Y, and Z. We're talking about a range of chronic problems all coming up and facing us at the same time. So climate change, a growing, you know, an increasingly aging population, crumbling infrastructure both nationally and locally, housing crisis. And the other one that struck me and I thought was really interesting and came through quite a lot too was the state of local government finance. So not only was there a overwhelming need for reform in central government, there was a complete consensus about the fact that local government also needs its own fundamental reforms, most notably around finance. So it was a big, important piece of work with a lot of quality input into it and really, really thought-provoking.
There we are. Alex, so this is the Fixing the Centre of Government, the final report on this Commission on the Centre of Government. What inspired it? What have you identified as kind of the issues that called for a report like this?
Yeah, well, first I'll just say, Kirsty, thank you. Keep it coming. I'll give you some. I listen to that all day after having poured the last year into this. So really appreciate what you said there. Why did we do this, and why did we do it sort of in this form? It's because, you know, we knew there was a problem. It's not, you know, it's not rocket science to say the central government has not been working brilliantly well for the last few years. Lots of people, you know, we've talked to before doing this and during this project will say, well, that's because of the people, it's the quality of the prime ministers, or it's the quality of the civil servants or the special advisors or whatever. And yes, that is right. Of course, the people are, you know, fundamentally, profoundly important about how the centre operates. But, you know, we wouldn't be the Institute for Government if we didn't also think that institutions and processes and structures matter as well. So we wanted to try and kind of get behind this sort of sense that the centre is not working, not supporting a prime minister as well as it as it should be, to take a proper look at number 10 as an organisation, the Cabinet Office and the Treasury, to see how they work individually and also how they work together. And what we found, but was, you know, surprise, surprise, it's not working as well as it should. There's a strategic gap at the heart of government. Governments have not been, successive governments, it's not a party political point at all, have not been very good at setting out their priorities in the start, being really clear about those and then sticking to them. One of the consequences of that is that, firstly, kind of government is buffeted, but secondly, just because you don't explicitly set out strategy doesn't mean strategy doesn't then sort of happen by itself. And one of the things we found was that the Treasury, as a strong and powerful institution at the centre, sort of fills that vacuum of strategy. And so then your government strategy is implicitly the Treasury's strategy, which is fine if you're the Treasury, but it's not fine if you're the whole government. So it distorts the decisions that are made in all sorts of ways. Two other quick points. One is, like it or not, and some people don't, but we recognise that the Prime Minister is the executive leader of government, and they're still the sort of the arrangements around them are still kind of the sort of first among equals, weaker, smaller number 10. And so we need to recognise that the leadership that only the centre of government can offer has to come from the Prime Minister, and they should be supported to do it, which has led to some of our recommendations. And then finally, the civil service needs some care and attention as well, and needs a dedicated department, dedicated senior minister to look at it. We've argued at the IFG for quite a long time that civil service needs a stronger statutory underpinning to be really clear about what its responsibilities are, and then to provide a kind of impetus for improving capability and reform. So we thought there were some pretty major gaps. I can talk about some of the recommendations if it's interesting, but that's our problem definition.
You know, and anybody that's worked at number 10 will have recognised a lot of what was said yesterday. And that I was particularly struck by the point about, you know, and many people have written about it and talked about it, which is that you kind of get into number 10 and you pull a lever and you find it's made of wool. It doesn't work. And, you know, why am I in number 10 and, you know, I can't make anything work? And just as a sort of funny aside, Dominic Cummings wrote a blog years ago, way before he was Dominic Cummings, as it were, and it was talking about the dysfunctionality of the operation at number 10. And he said it's so dysfunctional that you half expect to open a door in a cupboard under the stairs and find that actually the country's being run by a group of secret ninjas who live under the stairs at number 10. And then he says, there are no ninjas, there is no door. And me and another spad, whenever we were faced, this is before I went to number 10, whenever we were faced with number 10 tomfoolery, we used to just look at each other and go, there are no ninjas, there is no door. And this is the essence of it. And so, well, Alex can talk to the specificity and we can talk about how some of the policy recommendations rub up against the thorny issue of politicians and personalities. But, and this is a crude interpretation, but in essence, what they're trying to do is rebalance the power, if you like, of the office of Prime Minister. So if you think in a kind of corporate structure, what you do is you remove him kind of from the day-to-day-ery and you make him a chief executive officer of you know, the corporation that we call government. He sets the strategic priorities and the direction of travel. And then underneath that, you have, in effect, a kind of chief operating officer, which is, first Secretary of State, role, which is responsible for driving the kind of day-to-day issues of government, so that the Prime Minister doesn't get sucked into the weeds of, you know, day-to-day buffeting of politics and stuff. And that has a lot of attraction, I think, from being able to rebalance and set that kind of direction of travel that all departments can then work to. And frankly, all corporations work in this way. You've got chief finance officer, a chief operating officer, and a chief executive officer. But in government, we don't have this. We have this kind of crazy system that grew up. And that's the other thing the IFGs. Like, this didn't grow up because it was some great thought out process. It grew out through, like, in a typically wonderful British way, a load of historical quirkery, basically. So you have a completely imbalanced centre. This is overall an attempt to rebalance it, to free up people that need to be freed up for strategic thinking, and to put some more time and effort and accountability of delivery into the civil service too, by again separating out that role too. So you've got one person that's the cabinet secretary and has all the time with the prime minister, and someone that's responsible for the day-to-day delivery of the civil service too.
I mean, picking up on something you said there, because it's, I think it's really important as well. We're arguing for a stronger centre. We think that the centre at the moment is too weak. So we do think it should be stronger. But it's really important to say that is entirely consistent with decentralisation, giving secretaries of state and departments and devolved tiers of government their space to do what they need to do. So we're saying that the centre needs to be stronger in doing what only it can do. And then it needs to let people go to get on with delivering those priorities. And I actually think one of the reasons why you see this kind of micromanaging being drawn into number 10 in particular, you know, chess sets being bid for by local authorities being managed out of number 10 at the most extreme and absurd example, is a symptom of weakness. You know, number 10 can't control the woolen levers or the rubber levers that people talk about, as Kirsty was saying. You know, what do you do if you're in that environment? Well, you try and draw stuff close to you that matters to you. And actually, if you have a stronger centre, I think that would encourage prime ministers to be a bit more confident in devolving and decentralising stuff. So for me, those are really, they fit together. Some of the other things we're suggesting is you set out at the start of a government priorities for government, and then you actually announce those as part of a King's speech, a modernised King's speech. Which at the moment is a list of legislation and a few other kind of random things like diplomatic visits and stuff, always struck me as odd that it's this sort of, you know, bills that may or may not actually happen. And actually, even if it's not in the King's speech, you can still introduce it to Parliament anyway. So why not use that moment to actually set out your whole set of outcomes and objectives that you want to achieve, recognising things will change and you can then need to adapt them based on what happens. We're saying you should get rid of number 10 in the cabinet office, which is probably the most radical sort of structural change, and create a department of the prime minister and cabinet. So lose number 10, lose the cabinet office. The bits of the cabinet office that are currently kind of focused on the prime minister and the cabinet would go into this new department that would properly support the prime minister, and it would be geared around the priorities for government. It would have data and analytical teams that exist but are in their infancy. It would have performance tracking and teams, you know, built around the functions that you need to support that sort of prime minister as chief executive. And then you'd put the other bits of the cabinet office, which has grown from about 6,000 people 10 years ago to about 10, 11, 12,000 now. It's really grown a lot. You'd put most of those people into a department for the civil service that would be under a separate head of the civil service that was working too, as Kirsty said, this first secretary of state, who would be a kind of, you know, an operational deputy to the prime minister, who would be making sure that departments were getting on with those priorities for government. And you'd also then have a process at the start of a parliament for setting a spending review, which binds the treasury in and the decisions that the treasury makes to those priorities for government. We're lots of think tanks, lots of others have argued that you should split up the treasury. We thought about that really hard, really carefully, but in the end we decided not to go there because we want to harness the power of the treasury. The treasury is the one bit of the system that works, for goodness sake. So let's harness the power of the treasury to whole government priorities rather than trying to split it up to weaken it.
And then just to get into, you know, it is entirely possible to change the system of how government operates to improve delivery and improve outcomes but not with all personalities and all politicians. So when we talk about this kind of model of, to all intents and purposes, a chief executive officer style of prime minister, and a first secretary of state, a chief operating officer type of model, you know, I think I thought instinctively when I heard that about David Cameron and George Osborne. I know George Osborne was in the Treasury, but in essence, that's kind of what you had. You had, you know, a combined chief finance officer, chief operating officer. Osborne was in charge of kind of a lot of the domestic stuff. And Cameron had a much more, you know, chief executive, foreign, you know, Britain's relationship, stakeholder engagement type of role. And it worked very well. But how often, I mean, can you see that working? You know, if you think back to Blair and Brown, you know, so you'd need to have the right combination. I'm not saying it's not possible. Everything in life is possible. But it would have to be a right balance and a right mix of politicians and personality types to be able to make that the system function better, but also the personalities within that system make that system work in the way that, you know, the restructuring would be designed to do. And interestingly, one of the other ideas that the IFG came up with, which was kind of underlined by an announcement from Labour yesterday about, in effect, Keir Starmer wanting to set up a quad, a sort of inner cabinet. It is one of the recommendations, again, about improving both the strength of Number 10 and its, you know, and improving deliverability. The first thing I heard when I heard the Labour announcement was, way to cheese off the rest of the cabinet. And actually, funnily enough, it was the thing that both Gordon Brown and John Major picked up on as being a potential problem, not, you know, a potential issue with this. Because some of the problem with the office of Prime Minister is it's all about access. The people around judge their worth by their ability to access the Prime Minister. There's something very courtly about Number 10. And this sort of, and something very unseemly about this constant kind of polite battle for access. So, you know, again, it's not impossible to do, but you need the right kind of personalities and people who are genuinely focused on public service. And some of these politicians do exist. I know some of them and I've met some of them, you know, but genuinely, you know, focused on public service and doing right by their country rather than, you know, playing a kind of political snakes and ladders game with each other.
And you talk about a polite battle for access, Kirsty, sometimes not so polite. It's interesting you pick up on this. We call it an executive committee. You know, you can call it what you want, but this sort of smaller, basically a kind of strategy committee that the current cabinet has got, what, 33 people, 32 people sitting around the table attending cabinet at the moment. That's no way to make a decision or, you know, run a proper meeting. So we did, you know, we toyed with, do we just recommend a smaller cabinet? But we thought, well, that's not going to happen because Prime Minister values their power of patronage too highly. So you need an inner cabinet of some sort. All prime ministers end up doing this. So I slightly disagree, you know, with every respect, obviously, to John Major and Gordon Brown. I get the political difficulty of it. You don't want to hack off all your cabinet, the other cabinet ministers who aren't in the kind of inner team. But in practice, it does tend to happen. Blair did it. You know, the coalition did formalise it around the Quad. I was a civil servant at that time, and actually that worked pretty well. And you know, the Quad was one of our inspirations for recommending this this approach. And I think if a prime minister does it from a position of strength at the start of their term, and they say, of course, you know, secretaries of state will be involved in all the decisions that affect their departments, and they will have a place at the table of full cabinet, but the overall government strategy, the fiscal rules, the big cross-cutting spending decisions are going to be taken by this kind of core team. I do think that's doable. It's obviously there's a political cost, but I think it's achievable.
Yeah. So inspired by this report and this idea of strengthening it, one of the things I did think about was some of the subcommittees of cabinet that came out of Brexit and presumably out of COVID too, combined with Gordon Brown's point about having a National Economic Council, which would be a kind of cross-departmental ministers and officials in the same way as we have a National Security Council. And I thought about one of the ways to counter this kind of inner sanctum, you know, issue about having a very small amount of people having access and everybody else feeling cheesed off is you could have subcommittees of cabinet. And so I even went even further, Alex, in my nerdery and identified, and you can call them task force, much like we had task force of talent for COVID and for vaccines and what have you. So, you know, off the back of some of the big ticket issues that we talked about so much during the IFG launch of this report. So you could have three that are chaired by the Prime Minister, because thanks to this new structure, he has time to chair and coordinate and focus on the priorities. So one, to improve productivity and cut waiting times in the NHS. Two, to move to these are all my slight, you know, hobby horses, move to a rules-based planning system to speed house building and infrastructure, and then reform local government finance and improve local infrastructure. So, you know, the whole point of, and this was what was really interesting about the IFG, they're not talking about taking power away from the Treasury, they're talking about building up the power of number 10 in the right way, so that it's about strategic direction of travel. I wrote in big letters, I wrote a lot, but in big letters I wrote devolve and coordinate. And that's the, you know, that is the whole point of it. At the moment, we have a Prime Minister who spent the last 2 days discussing whether something, you know, getting caught in like kind of party political matters. And, you know, if you set a direction of travel, you know, it's much easier for the rest of Whitehall not to get knocked off course all the time by just, you know, being buffeted by events, and then therefore making the government look more front-footed all the time.
Mm-hmm. So we hear that and we get it, and like it makes sense from out here. How much does this depend on a Prime Minister being willing to make these changes, and how realistic actually is that, Alex, in your estimation?
So I think, obviously, it depends on Prime Ministers wanting to do it. You said earlier that there are some suggestions that the Labour Party are interested in picking up, particularly this sort of, you know, core committee idea. I think there is a real appetite for setting out priorities. I think the sort of strategic vacuum point that I made earlier is recognised, and I think particularly amongst on the Labour side, there's an appetite for the kind of opening up and devolve, you know, strengthen to devolve point that Kirsty was talking about earlier. So I think it's in the ether, powder being kept more dry on, you know, should you create a department of the Prime Minister, abolish the Cabinet Office, all of this sort of things. But I think the thing that comes to me is, if Rishi Sunak is re-elected after the, you know, at the election, he will need something to replace the five pledges, depending on kind of where they've got to. But that will be a government in need of a strategic objective. Keir Starmer and the Labour Party have got these missions, and we think this model is entirely consistent with either of those, because the parties will develop their manifestos. They'll be sort of have more or less policy in them, but you then need, this is where I do think Keir Starmer's onto something with the missions, you need a way of translating a manifesto whose primary job is to help you win the election. You know, of course, it's, you know, it sets out a policy program, and there's a kind of accountability mechanism there. At the end, it's to try and get you over the line to win the election. You need a mechanism to translate that into how government is going to work. And that's the thing, I think, that missions, you could say, well, your priorities for government are based around those missions. You need a way to align budgets to those missions. And so I sort of think, one way or another, Labour, if they're serious about missions, and I think they are, sort of have to do something around this. And then there are other aspects of it around the civil service and the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet that you can, you know, we would argue should do, but you can sort of take or leave. So I think I feel pretty optimistic that elements of it will come through. We'll obviously see. We'll keep banging on about it for the next however long.
Yeah, fair. Kirsty, can you sell it to the public? That's the other thing. Does it need sold to the public, or is this just something that a Prime Minister can get on with?
No, I mean, I think if you simply turn around and said, you know, this is a way of making your government work better for you, that's it, right? I mean, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
There are lots of things that, you know, political nerds like me will be able to talk about at great length for a very long time. I love the point about, you know, the ever-growing size of the cabinet and the amount of, you know, attending ministers you now have around cabinet table, which is an insanity. It's almost like, you know, the cabinet table is a certain size, and I'm kind of half expecting one day to come in and someone's added a child's table at the end, because there's just not enough, you know, even allow for all the bum squeezing on seats and, you know, There's just not enough space around the actual table right now. And someone gets one of those garden trestle tables in and throws a cloth over it.
They're scrabbling around.
And some garden fold-out chairs. I mean, look, some of it is kind of, you know, political, Westminster bubbly, interesting stuff. But basically, for the public, it is hugely important. This is about a way of making government work better and ensuring that the outcomes are what is focused on here and not kind of inputs and outputs, and that it's actually outcomes.
And I think this is all, it's all, you know, good fun, nerdy stuff. But to try and relate it to, there is a danger in these conversations, you get very abstract. Levelling up. Why didn't levelling up really work? It's because it wasn't properly embedded into the structures and the fabric of how government was going about its business. And it became a kind of succession of funds and pots of money and things that would be allocated from the centre of government. It wasn't actually embedded in, you know, a sort of a hugely cross-cutting, cross-departmental priority that was the personal priority of the Prime Minister for a long time. But, you know, one of the points we make in the report is that levelling up, Boris Johnson made a speech about 2 years in, I think, to his office about what he thought levelling up was, and then Michael Gove produced a white paper, you know, after that. And the budgets for levelling up had been set for 2 years, so it was retrofitted to those budgets. So you should be doing all of that at the same time. I think the same about preventive health. Governments of all colours have talked about preventative health care. We need to do more about obesity, we need to do more about mental health, but it never takes root because the government doesn't embed that in its actual set of priorities, and the sort of behemoth of the NHS and the need to fund that takes over. So I do think there's a link, and you know it's for us to do the sales job, I suppose, but there's a link between quite tangible things that matter to prime ministers and matter to the public that aren't happening because the way the centre of government is set up is sort of confused, tripping over itself, not holding fast to a set of clear objectives.
Very, very interesting. Alex, thank you so much. Thanks for joining the podcast. It's great to do some, well, I mean, even more nerdery than usual. So know that you're always welcome to join us for that. Thank you so much.
Anytime. Thank you for having me, and glad you enjoyed the report.
Thank you.